So, that stone, actually, believe it or not, is still there. It is right there on the Temple Mount, right now, covered by a massive structure called the Dome of the Rock. It's known as the Dome of the Rock because the rock is underneath it. And the entire structure encases that rock. And if you go and have a look at photographs and pictures of that place, you can see it. The Muslim people built that in the late 7th century AD. They built that place, and it has stood for over 1,300 years, protecting that rock. Even the Crusaders, the Crusaders took the place and used that Dome of the Rock as a cathedral, a kind of a place of worship, and then it was taken back again by Saladin and his troops, and they restored again the worship of Allah in that place. But that rock represents to them a place where Muhammad was taken up and had his vision of the ascending and descending staircase and the angels of the Lord, and took his trip to heaven with the angel Gabriel. That's in the Quran. That rock is hugely important in three world religions, because it is also the rock, of course, where Solomon built his temple, and it's the place where the Holy of Holies stood, and the Ark of the Covenant was actually placed upon that rock because of the significance of it. The reason why it was chosen by David, or it was actually chosen by the Lord, was because of the great plague that took place in the end of 2 Samuel. You can read about this, but David purchases that piece of rock from a fellow by the name of Arawuna. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Arawuna. Anyway, somebody can help me one day. Go study Hebrew and come back and tell me how to pronounce his name. Ornan, he's called in one of the other places, so let's just go with that. He is a Jebusite, and he owns that, and David purchases it from him, because the angel of the Lord stops the plague right there, and there he determines that that's where the house of the Lord should be built. Solomon builds the temple there. Ezra, later, after the temple has been destroyed, Ezra rebuilds a temple there in the 6th century BC. And then Herod rebuilds Ezra's temple and makes it even more beautiful in the 1st century BC. And of course, Jesus is standing on that rock when he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate." Now you must understand, as he stands on this rock, or at least close to this rock, the proximity to the foundation stone, which, by the way, was well known in Israel at that time. Everybody knew of this stone. It was revered. It is still revered. It is the most holy site in all the Jewish faith. It is the third most holy site in the Muslim faith. It is a holy site to the Christians because it was just across the way where Jesus was crucified. Okay, so this has become a very important place in all of our lives, a geographical place. This foundation stone, whether it or not it was the place where God stood and created the earth, I don't know, and don't believe that, but you know, whatever, it's just, you know, it may be, maybe God will show that one day. That'd be pretty poetic and amazing. But regardless of that, it holds that place of prominence in people's minds. And the reason it holds that place of prominence is because it caps the chaos. It caps the chaos. And so a rock, a dead rock, a physical rock that cannot speak, a mute rock, covers the chaos. And laws have been established in order to maintain the position of that rock, the place of that rock. Nobody can move it. Don't you dare move it. Chaos would ensue. Even in our day and age today, is it not true that if somebody launched a missile at the Dome of the Rock, the world would erupt into chaos? This is not true. You touch that rock and you'll spark a war. Fascinating, isn't it? When Jesus stands there and he says, "Your house is left to you desolate," that is a very powerful statement. Because that same place was known as Beth El, the house of God. But here he says it's not God's house anymore. It's your house. Jesus goes to that rock and he says, the age of this being the foundation stone is over. It's over. It was never meant to be. This is not the foundation. It's one of the reasons why Jesus got killed. Because Jesus went in the face of all of that religion and he said, this is not the foundation. Your religion is based on a false premise. You believe that somehow the rock has significance. But Jesus says, I am the rock. Jesus says, I am the rock. Now, listen, this is powerful for a number of reasons. Jesus has explained to the Pharisees, who, by the way, protect and guard that rock, and they did it in that day and age, they do it today. They're Muslims now, but the same, you know, false religion is false religion, whether you're a Pharisee or a Muslim or even a Christian. False religion is false religion, okay? And false religion does this. False religion imposes rules and regulations. False religion has legalism. It has an elevation of leaders. Jesus said to the Pharisees, you love the best place at the seats. You want to be called teacher and rabbi. You want everybody to exalt you. He says to his disciples, don't let anybody call you teacher or rabbi or father. No elevation. True religion, there's no elevation of the leaders. By the way, if you find yourself in a church or in some sort of some communal setting where there is an elevation of the leaders, I want you to know it's false religion. It's false religion. Guess what we have in America? We have an elevation of our leaders. We revere and honor. Now, honor is one thing. Honor and respect is one thing. But to idolize and to place on position, on pedestals and positions of extreme authority and places where they are exempt, people are exempt from the same rules that govern us, uh-uh. That's false religion. That's idolatry. So guess what our American government is? It's idolatry. I told you it was going to get tough in here now because I'm about to step on some toes. We established that as the capstone for the chaos. We said, capstone for the chaos. We're going to have a leadership that have just, they're just so far above everybody else that you just worship them practically. They can do anything they want. They can say anything they want as long as they maintain the shalom. Has our government been able to maintain the shalom? No, because it's a false religion. It's a false religion. So it's not religion, it's politics. Guess what? It's false religion. Jesus says, don't have anybody call you father. Don't have them set you up as some place of elevator. Okay, so false religion has an elevation of leaders. Jesus says true religion has humble leaders. Leaders who are servants. Honor and respect given to them, but they are servants. They know better than anybody else, and they don't think of themselves as better than anybody else. So if you find yourself in a church that has an elevated leadership, get out of there quick. It's a false religion. Okay, secondly, leaders are not exempt. In Jesus' true religion, leaders are not exempt from the code established for the followers. He says, Pharisees, you lay heavy burdens on everybody else, but you're not willing to lift a finger yourself. Matthew 23. So if the leaders are imposing rules, but the leaders are not following those rules, false religion, get out of there. Okay? Take heed to yourself. Get out of there. Better to have a leader who is recognized as somebody who has faults and who openly admits those faults and seeks the forgiveness of the Lord on those faults than to have somebody who pretends to be perfect. Because there's only one perfect, and that's Christ. Okay? The other thing is you can't lead other people where you're not willing to go yourself. So a leadership that says, you must worship God, but they themselves do not worship God, forget it. Jesus says, you shut up the gates of heaven, the doors of heaven, and you yourselves won't even go in. That's what he says to the Pharisees. False religion shuts up the door of heaven because it says, hey, listen, I want you to all have an experience, but I'm not going to do that. So a worship, let's say we're in a worship setting and the leaders of the church are just not worshiping God. They're not engaged in worship. They're too busy with all the affairs of everything else, and they say, no, everybody else can worship for us. Guess what? They're standing on the edge of false religion. Standing on the edge of false religion. Now, I know that's not the only thing. I mean, obviously, there are times and seasons when people are occupied and preoccupied with things, and we can't judge our leaders in that way. But I'm going to say that people who do not engage with the congregation are setting themselves aloof from the congregation and in some way making themselves better than the congregation. Eventually, we're back to step one, which is where we have the elevation and the no humility thing. Okay, so what about influence being abroad and not at home? Jesus says, you travel land and sea. You traverse land and sea. So proud of yourselves to make a proselyte somewhere. You'll go all over the world to faraway places to lead someone to Christ. But will you do it at home? I don't think so. You know why? Because you can be whoever you want to out there and live this grand persona and be someone wide and wise and you can impress everybody, but you can't impress people at home because they know your character and they know who you are. He says, you go out to all those places and you pretend to be such and such, and you make those people twice as much a son of hell than what you were. False religion puts on a pretense in a faraway place, but cannot live that at home. Which is why you've got to be so careful of TV preachers. Because they don't have to live in front of you. They can say anything they want and you'll swallow it up. And the trouble with that is you don't know whether it's actually working in their life or not. And that's one of the ways God has given us to know between a false prophet and a true prophet. If what they say works, then it's a true prophet. If it's what they say doesn't work, then it's a false prophet. And you say, well, I don't have any way to tell whether they're telling me the truth or not. Because you don't live by them. So you have set yourself up to be trained by potential false teachers with no way of having any litmus test. Are they teaching me the right thing or not? False religion, my friends. You travel abroad, you put on great big TV shows, and you shine your stuff into faraway countries, but there's no way that those people can know that it actually works in your life. Far better to follow somebody who leads in humility and who leads from the purity and the honesty of their own home. Loopholes and excuses is another thing. That's what the Pharisees were doing. They were finding loopholes for everything, excuses for everything, and they did it with the promises people were making, the covenants they were making with one another in the temple of the Lord, swearing by the altar or by the gifts on the altar and so forth. And they devised rules and ways that people could have loopholes to get out of things that they had promised but didn't really want to pay. And so religion creates excuses for the wealthy or for the powerful, and it abuses the weak. And that's false religion. You say, well, that's the capstone on the chaos. It works that way. Have you ever read, you know, the Prince, Machiavelli's The Prince? You know, his ideas, which look horrible, worked. Well, not really. It doesn't really cap the chaos. It coexists with the chaos. It doesn't transform the chaos. External appearance is of no value when it conceals inner inconsistency. Those who separate themselves do so for selfish and carnal reasons under the guise of piety, and their pompous attitude defiles all who mimic them. They say, oh, don't touch me, because I'm holy. I've spent time in the presence of the Lord. But that attitude is like, it's like they're a whitewashed sepulcher. In the ancient days, in the times when people come in their convocation feasts from all over Israel to come to the holy city in order to worship God, they would be afraid lest, of course, they touch a dead body and be defiled for a whole week. I mean, if you're coming to sacrifice the Passover lamb, everybody's been called together. You don't want to be unclean, because if you're unclean, you can't go in. Right? So everybody wants to offer the sacrificial lamb, but what if you walk on someone's grave? If you step on a grave, now you're not from Jerusalem, so you don't know that, you know, the ascent up the hill of the Mount of Olives and coming over the top from the east into Jerusalem is actually, there's all graveyards everywhere there. And you might accidentally step on someone's grave because you don't know where it is. So what they would do is they would whitewash the graves. They would show so that travelers could know for sure, oh, that's a grave. Don't touch that. Don't go near that. You've got to stay a certain distance from it so you don't become unclean. That otherwise, you wouldn't be able to offer the sacrificial lamb. So they painted the tombs and they whitewashed them so people would say, oh, don't touch that. And Jesus said to the Pharisees, who were always saying, you can't, you know, don't come too close. Don't want to be touched by anybody unclean. I want to make sure that I get into, you know, the presence of the Lord. Jesus said, you are not keeping yourselves clean. You are like those whitewashed tombs. That if anybody touches you or mimics your attitude, they're going to be unclean. That's false religion for you. That's what false religion does. It separates us out in this false sense of piety, as if somehow I'm better than you. And don't touch my life. Don't come to me with your problems. I don't want to be affected by you. You ever had someone say, oh, be careful. Don't pray for people who are in trouble, because maybe their demons will jump on you. You laugh. It's not funny. People do that. There's a difference between being presumptuous and assuming that you've got something in God when you don't. Don't pretend that you have something in God that you don't have, okay? But don't be afraid of what's out in the world. Jesus doesn't say stay away from the world. He says go into the world. Go into the world, because the light that's in you will not be overcome by the darkness. That chaos, the mouth of the great serpent that the stone was supposed to be set on, it was called the gates of hell. And the capstone, or the which is the foundation of the temple, that stone over that mouth of that serpent, as it were, represented the gates that bar up hell and stop hell from coming out. In the ancient world, they felt that water coming forth, gushing forth from beneath the earth, that didn't have, you know, it wasn't a river that just disappeared and came back again. It was some subterranean water. They reckoned that was a portal to the underworld, and they felt that the underworld was bad and the world above was good. So they felt that anything that led down there would be called the gates of hell. So in Jerusalem, they had, you know, this idea that underneath Mount Moriah, God had stopped up the gates of hell. The stone stopped the gates of hell. Gates of hell shall not prevail against that stone, as it were. Well, Jesus, when he was accused of being, you know, inspired by Beelzebub and empowered by Beelzebub to cast out demons, he took a trip with his disciples. You know, the Pharisees had accused him of that. And he took a trip with his disciples to Caesarea Philippi. And this is an interesting lesson I learned from Ray Vandalon, a historian, in one of his videos. He talked about it. But in Caesarea Philippi, there was a place where there was one of these fountains from the depths that ushered forth water. It's changed now because of seismic movement. There's an earthquake back, you know, several centuries ago that changed it. But anyway, back then, if you'd gone there, you would have had this very, very cold water that just came bubbling forth from the earth and was a fountainhead. And they called it the gates of hell. And there, in Caesarea Philippi, which was a very Greek city, Hellenized city, they actually established these little niches in the wall, and they put their idols in the wall, especially the god Pan, but previous to that it had been Baal. And they worshipped that place, and Jesus took his disciples there because he'd been accused of being like Jezebel and, you know, under the power of Baal-zebub. He went there to say, hey, well, listen, they've accused me of being like Jezebel, essentially, bringing perversion to the people of Israel. But let me take you to a place where they really are worshiping that God and see if you can compare me and them, you know, and see if there's a real difference. So just a discipleship lesson is really what's happening. And so he goes there, and this is what the historian suggests based on what Caesarea Philippi is. And it's not in the scripture, it's conjecture, but it does make sense. So let's just say Jesus is sitting there on this hill overlooking this, you know, he's on the road to Caesarea Philippi, and there's this place where this gates of hell, as it were, and they're worshiping, and all the pagan worship is going on before them, and it's all debauchery and so forth. And Jesus kind of says to them, you know, who do men say that I am? And you can read about this earlier in Matthew. We discussed it at great length previously. But Jesus says, well, who do men say that I am? And so the disciples start to say, well, you know, I know that back there they kind of suggested you were like Ahab and Jezebel, but actually some people say you're like Elijah. You know, you're confronting the powers of darkness. You're not bringing the powers of darkness. And clearly, when we look at what Jezebel worship, you know, really was, as we see mimicked in front of us by this particular thing, you're not doing that. You're not calling what is good bad and what is bad good. Jesus, you're coming and setting the standard high and telling us about the Father. And so Jesus said, well, that's good. Who do you say that I am? And Peter looks at him, and Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Do you know what he's saying? He's saying, you are the foundation stone. You're the one that crushes the serpent's head. You're the one to bring order in the chaos.